are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
This is the... I can't hear anything. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday. Hopefully we will fix my sound shortly. On today's program, Brian Meir from Brazil Wire joins us to discuss why Bolsonaro won beyond the cliches. What happens next as the political prosecutor who savaged the Workers' Party and made Lula da Silva a political prisoner has just accepted a job in the new fascist regime. So good stuff for everybody that uncritically promoted anti-corruption politics and the car wash investigation. Right, indeed. Donald Trump calls for a citizenship protections a crazy policy. Early votes in at least 17 states have already surpassed 2014 turnouts at this point, days away from the crucial 2018 midterm elections. The Fed releases plans to loosen rules on U.S. banks. What could go wrong? Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke is facing months-long criminal probes. Apartheid Brian Kemp, he just ditched out on a debate with Stacey Abrams to campaign with Donald Trump, ditching it at the last minute, capitalizing on his racist leader and vote suppression in an election that Stacey Abrams will win unless Apartheid Brian steals it. Scott Walker and Tony Evers are tied in the final Marquette poll of the 2018. Scott Walker, his attacks on public sector unions in 2011 were a map of our austerity authoritarian future, but also another key part of the growing response, leftist grassroots response across this country. Trump administration approves Wisconsin Medicaid work requirements. Get out and get rid of Scott Walker. The Trump health official dubs Medicare for All the scariest Halloween costume. ACA enrollment begins today, and the Trump administration, of course, is not making it any easier for people to get their health care, and they promise to redouble their efforts to get rid of people's pre-existing conditions coverage. Pre-existing conditions, by the way, can mean everything from being a woman to having diabetes. Is a very broad range of things. Ew. Gross. And Steve King, the embattled white supremacist congressman, says Ted Cruz has expressed support for his campaign. Two supremacist peas in a pod.
Shocking.
Very shocking. Majid Nawaz, professional informant, blowhard, and tryhard, has some static with the straight edge Amy Winehouse herself, Lily Allen. That and much, much more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, everybody. Good to be here. We're going to get to Brian Meir in a few minutes at Brazil Wire. And we are all in the house besides the four-day work week, man. I don't know if we need to pretend. I'll just say, I guess we entered into a parallel universe yesterday, and I will say in that parallel universe, I thought Sam's AA semen was inspired. I thought that was an incredible mashup of almost like everything wrong with YouTube, and that was very funny.
The face he was making.
I thought he was killing it. He must have been really hurting his eyes to do that. And, yeah, it was hard to stay in character. But
I liked John from, was it El Paso?
I think John from El Paso did a great job.
Yeah, great job, whoever you are.
Yeah, we don't know who that is, but that was brilliant. And I also really appreciate it. I was saying in the office earlier, we could defend any part of that sketch besides the Brandon character, which might have been the funniest part of all of it. The idea of him... of him chewing the wires.
Chewing the wire now.
We're safe.
All right, shit.
Not going to go back into that.
We're not that far from that. Dave Chappelle and Jon Stewart were on CNN talking to Christiane Amanpour. Dave Chappelle is, of course, one of our greatest comedians. He's incredibly insightful. And Christiane Amanpour is supposed to be the sort of regal global sophisticate of CNN. And I've seen her do some decent reporting from time to time. She certainly gets a lot of heat because of her background and because of being a woman and because she has an accent. But she's just not in her depth here on this conversation about the fascist wave, the American fascist wave that Trump is riding.
She's not in the comedian's depth here.
She's not in the comedian's depth here. Dave Chappelle certainly is.
Some of the things they say, even when they say that Russia influenced the election, it's kind of like, is Russia making us racist? Is that who's doing it? Okay, I thought it was. Oh my God, thank goodness, yeah. I thought it was us.
I hadn't thought of it that way.
Yeah, if they kill the country that way, then we're the murder weapon.
Yeah.
So
we've always been.
Is the Trump era a good era for comedians? Oof. Is it just unbelievable fodder or not?
I would not even name the era after him.
Yeah.
He's getting too much credit.
Well, he's the president.
He's not the president. Making the wave, he's surfing it.
Yeah.
They were talking crazy. All he does is sing those people's greatest hits. Build a wall, all these things we've heard before. He just sings all the songs. He's the only one that has been brash enough to do it.
That's exactly right. In the beginning, and this is actually another good thing, I think, to remember as we synthesize race and economics into analysis of figuring out the electorate and specifically the Trump base. I did say from the very beginning in 2016, Donald Trump will most likely win the Republican primary because he's doing something brilliant from the political perspective of a Republican primary, which is being unequivocally racist and xenophobic and speaking that clearly and robustly to a party whose non-oligarchs, and most of their oligarchs too, frankly, are built on white identity politics. And conversely, he was lying, obviously, but he was questioning Republican economic orthodoxies, which normal Republican voters don't care about. I recently was canvassing in Idaho, and I met a very charming lady in her 80s, and she said, "What do you boys want?" And after telling us that she was going to vote Republican and that Democrats are full of shit and saying some horrible things about immigration, she then went on to say, "And of course, yep, I'm voting for Medicaid expansion because people need health care." And Donald Trump tapped into that. He recognized that, of course, even a lot of normal Republican voters understand that giving money to Koch brothers and making it easier to abuse them and deregulate is bad for them. But they're also rooted in white identity politics as well. These things are both true. And Dave Chappelle pointed out exactly the case, that this is a continuing current of American history. And Trump is this era's showman who's known how to exploit it. And there's really nothing special about it if you have any historical understanding of the threat that we face and everything that Trump and this whole gang symbolizes.
Yeah, if it weren't him, it would definitely be somebody else. And it's amazing how few liberals in the media really seem to grasp this. They want to blame it all on Trump and Russia. Like, if it weren't for those two actors, we would be totally fine. And that's just not true.
Yeah, I think the only limited way in which that is true is that I don't think any of the other. I mean, Hillary also throws a wrench into this, but just looking at the Republican field in general, there's a reason it wasn't a career Republican, right?
Right.
Is because you can't people are sick of that shit.
Right.
But so it had to be this celebrity with a built-in different sort of constituency, like reality TV heads. And
the third contingent that we'll get into with Brian, but it does apply to the United States as well, is this amorphous anti-corruption politics, which doesn't mean anything and is decontextualized from politics. And that is why anti-corruption politics helped lead to the rise of Berlusconi. It has been instrumental in Bolsonaro and drained the swamp, obviously.
And he is turning over the tables in the swamp.
Exactly. And what is corruption? I mean, any conversation of corruption that doesn't involve the fundamental structure of capitalism is delusional. Today's show is brought to you by Brook Linen, named the winner of the best online bedding category for good housekeeping. Brook Linen is the fastest growing bedded brand in the world with over 20,000 five-star reviews. Their mission is to bring five-star hotel quality sheets to everyday life, offering luxury sheets without the luxury markup. Their method, eliminating the middleman and keeping things personal from design to manufacturing to customer service and beyond. These sheets are amazing. Until I got my Brook Linen sheets, I didn't really get the difference. I got, of course, you want cotton, not polyester. Some things are more comfortable than other things. Of course. I've never had sheets before until I had Brook Linen that make me sleep better, that make me fire off one final tweet of the night to piss somebody off. And then I go into a gentle, peaceful, deep and renewing slumber. Also, I can get up back in the morning and watch Donald Trump do something horrible. But these sheets have totally changed how I sleep. They have the highest quality, and you can get exactly the types that you want, from style to texture. Excellent sleeping experience. My Brook Linen sheets are the best and most comfortable sheets I've ever slept on. Brooklinen.com is giving an exclusive offer just for Majority Report listeners. Get $20 off and free shipping when you use promo code MAJORITY at Brooklinen.com. Brook Linen is so sure that you'll love your new sheets that they offer a risk-free 60-night satisfaction guarantee and a lifetime warranty on all their sheets and comforters. Believe me, you're not going to use it. These things are incredibly comfortable. The only way to get $20 off and free shipping is to use promo code MAJORITY at brooklinen.com. That's BROOKLINEN.com. Promo code MAJORITY. Brook Linen. These really are the best sheets ever. And another thing I want to tell you about in today's show is News Voice. One of today's show sponsors is newsvoice.com/majority. We all know about the harmful effects of media conglomerates in today's discourse. We focus, obviously, on this show from the left on dealing with the consequences of corporate media that for decades has not covered anything from labor issues to inequality to U.S. foreign policy in a serious way. And now we're in all of these epistemic bubbles and our information systems are closed. So people both lose access to facts and objective analysis, but also fail to have a broader understanding of what is motivating different parts of the American electorate. You need to understand how everybody's thinking if you want to figure out how the country's working and how the world is moving. You got to get out of your filter bubble to do that. And not just ideologically, but globally as well. One thing that I do, and News Voice helps me do, is follow a lot of global news outlets, both on international issues, if I'm following South America or the Middle East or Africa or Europe or Asia, but also to look at how they're covering us, because that brings a whole different perspective as well. There's a new media company that's come up with its own response to these problems, and it's called News Voice. It's an app for it's an app for iOS and Android, which you can access for free if you go to newsvoice.com/majority. It gives you a personalized news feed by aggregating a mix of mainstream media sources, international sources, and independent media sources. Multiple sources are provided for each news story. And that's exactly, Sam says this, it's exactly how we prepare for hosting these shows. You get a range, you look at, you know, the sort of big traditional players, how they're covering it. Then you go and you find specialists, then you get other people on the left, then you're going to look at how the right's framing it. And that way you can formulate your analysis and strategy. The entire app is fueled by crowdsourcing. You can upvote stories you think are important so people will see them. You can add stories to the app, or you can add a source that's missing for a story. It's meant to be completely open and democratized news aggregator that lets you get every side of every story. They also have a video interview series featuring guests from Chris Hedges to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Go out, download the app for free at newsvoice.com/majority. And we've put a link under this video if you're watching on YouTube. We're going to take a brief break, and we'll be right back with Brian Mier on the Majority Report. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Brian Mier. He joins us from Sao Paulo, Brazil, and he is the co-editor of Brazil Wire. His latest piece just released is Why Bolsonaro Won Beyond the Clichés, which you can find at Brazil Wire, which, as I always say, is really an indispensable resource for understanding what's happening in Brazil currently and the history that led us to where we are today. Brian, thanks so much for being back.
Thanks a lot. How's it going?
It's going pretty well. We have to maintain our spirit. How's it going for you, I would say, would be a more pertinent question with what just happened the last couple of days.
Yeah, it's kind of stressful, you know, because I've been coming on Brazilian TV, bad-mouthing, rightfully so, bad-mouthing Bolsonaro all year.
Yep.
And some people have even made memes with me. bad-mouthing Bolsonaro, and right. Now he's saying he's going to arrest or exile all of the so-called communists. And his list of communists is so broad that it includes the classical liberal magazine, The Economist.
Right.
He's calling that communist. Right. Everything's communist to him.
Right, because they didn't support him for president, which is essentially his definition. I mean, you know, would you do that first? Because particularly when we cover the United States, I think there obviously is a global far-right movement, and there is a connection and a synchronization between Donald Trump and Bolsonaro, and it relates to what we see in Hungary, in India, and frankly in Argentina and Chile, and I would argue in the Gulf, and I'd argue in Russia, I'd argue in some leadership in Africa. This is all true, and we need to draw those parallels. At the same time, this is a guy who is at the forefront, and I know people get into pedantry of how you define fascism, this or that. That really doesn't interest me. But he is a full, thoroughgoing, absolute political, social, ethnic cleanser authoritarian, along with being a ultra neoliberal. So just really re-anchor who this guy is. This isn't just alarmism.
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, I saw some stupid articles online, hair splitting about whether he's a fascist or not.
Right.
Because he's not German and it's not the 1930s or whatever. But let's not forget that Noam Chomsky coined the term neo-fascism to describe the Latin American military dictatorships of the 60s and 70s, principally the Brazilian one, and Jair Bolsonaro was a member of that regime. And he's appointing three former generals from that regime. And so he's literally a neo-fascist. There's no, you know, the term neo-fascist was coined to describe a regime that he was part of.
Right.
Okay, so I don't see any... And that's a difference between him and someone like Donald Trump, who I feel is an opportunistic con man.
Right.
You know, who's using some alt-right rhetoric. He's fostering Nazism, neo-Nazis within the U.S. or whatever. But he's not actually, you know, he didn't grow up goose-stepping around in the midst of a dictatorship.
Right. he's a racist trust fund baby scumbag slumlord who is a white supremacist and knows how to hustle and con people and is a far-right corporatist like the rest of the Republican Party, but not literally a member of a military junta.
Yeah, like Bolsonaro was. Right. And, you know, a junta that's gets let off easy by a lot of people who say, oh, it was the lightest of the Latin American dictatorships because they only killed 500 people. But that is a terrible misnomer, because they only killed 500 white middle-class political prisoners. They didn't count blacks and indigenous people deaths in their death count.
Right.
And so, like, on one night in 1969, they machine-gunned down an entire indigenous tribe in the Amazon, 2,000 men, women, and children. You know, and they tortured babies, they tortured children. This guy who Bolsonaro dedicated his impeachment vote to Dilma Rousseff for, Brilliante Ustra, was a head torturer who was known for sticking rats up women's vaginas. You know? So this guy is a fascist. He's a neo-fascist.
Yep.
He's horrible, you know? And he's using this fascist rhetoric that Hitler did, okay? Yep. That the CIA trained Latin American juntas to do during the dictatorship era, which is to transform the army's main goal from self-defense into defeating an internal enemy. The internal enemy of Hitler was the Jews.
Right.
And the internal enemy that Bolsonaro is talking about are the communists. And he considers, like, the types of people he labels to be communists, even McCarthy would be like, whoa, slow down, Bolsonaro.
Right.
You know?
Right.
How can you call the economist communists? But he's talking about, really, a segment of at least 50 million people in Brazil who he's now declaring internal enemy. And he just appointed a lieutenant colonel, former astronaut, to be head of science and technology. And in his acceptance speech, the guy said, oh, yes, well, I'm prepared to fight external and internal enemies for Brazil. It's like, well, what position did you just accept? Science and technology. It sounds like you accepted the, you know, a military command or something.
So, yeah, I mean, this could not be more disturbing, obviously, but it's also something that people like you and other journalists, frankly, I mean, between the Brazil Wire and reporting in The Intercept and some things that I've done in Majority Report, Michael Brooks Show, Real News. I mean, look, these are all independent sources, obviously, but if you were looking to find out what the real nature of this guy was and also what led up to it, you would be able to find it in English language news. But at the flip side, and I want you to talk about the media piece, it might be harder to find it in Portuguese news because of the role that the media has played in delegitimizing the Workers' Party and facilitating fascism, and also in the utter failure of The Guardian, The New York Times, and also the direct complicity of people like, you know, of places like The Wall Street Journal, which are back to their old tricks and directly endorsing fascism and murderers.
Yeah, well, that's a several. Seems yeah. like several questions wound up in yeah. one.
Well, take them by three. Take them one at a time.
Press, I will. Regarding the Portuguese language press, luckily, there's a very robust alternative leftist press in Brazil. There's some really great publications, and because of the internet and stuff, the traditional media outlets that supported the first military dictatorship, a lot of them are going into bankruptcy now. You know, and regularly being beaten in readership by newer alternative press mediums, like, for example, Forum Magazine, which was created during the First World Social Forum and has people like Leonardo Boff, João Pedro Stegeli, who's head of the MST, Leonardo Boff, a famous liberation theologian,
yep.
you know, on their board of their editorial board. They're fantastic. And there's other publications as well. Brasil do Fato is connected with the MST, and they have started publishing some stuff in English. If you type in their name and English afterwards, you'll usually find a couple articles a week, and they're a good source in Portuguese. But anyway, that's the Brazilian media. The mainstream Brazilian media, which supported the military dictatorship and has been spreading anti-PT hatred for the last 15 years, in the case of Globo, since the 1980s, really, they're now being labeled as communists by Bolsonaro. And Bolsonaro threatened to shut down the largest newspaper in the country, which is no friend of the PT party, the Folha de São Paulo. last week on live national TV, he said he's going to shut them down. So it's weird. And then regarding the Anglo media, I would say total and utter failure by The Guardian and The New York Times. They didn't just fail on this. They're complicit in the rise of fascism in Brazil because they've lied and spread mistruths about the accusations against Lula and Dilma. They toned down the fact that he's a political prisoner, and they propped up this Sergio Moro, who is a U.S. government operative working in tandem with the Department of Justice for years now, who has just accepted the cabinet position of Minister of Security for Bolsonaro. So he's openly joining a fascist regime now. And for the last 3 years, we've been hearing all of these fluff pieces about what an impartial anti-corruption crusader he is. He arrested the leading candidate in this year's elections on no charges with no physical evidence and sentenced him to 9 years in jail in a sadistic manner because Lula has nine fingers and that was his nickname for him, nine.
Yep.
All right. He prevented Lula. He illegally prevented Lula from being released on a habeas corpus while he was on vacation. And he illegally leaked information to the press, falsely implicating Fernando Haddad in corruption during the election campaign, directly benefiting Bolsonaro. And now he's accepting a cabinet position.
So we're going to talk more about Moro and Lula in a bit and just, again, reframe the importance of the lies and the U.S. relationship to that political prosecution and that broader political project. But and some of the – even the kind of delusional credulousness about Moro even in, you know, independent outlets. But before we get there, you're laying out the myth – you talk about of why Bolsonaro won, and the two main issues that we hear in still in the Anglo press, even as they've started to hand-wring and freak out about this guy, they still will say that Brazilian voters were fed up with violence and corruption. What were the actual – were those the actual reasons that Bolsonaro won this victory?
No, Bolsonaro won because they arrested the leading candidate, was, you know, polling – with over double the popularity as Bolsonaro and would have won in the first round, even from behind bars, which was his legal right to do. That's one reason. Another reason is that he committed electoral crime with support from Steve Bannon using WhatsApp social media app to spread lies to millions of people about the PT party and Fernando Haddad that had nothing to do with violence or corruption. They spread lies trying to portray the PT party as a bunch of sexual perverts who are going to force your children to become homosexuals.
Right.
That Haddad distributed erotic baby bottles in the Sao Paulo public preschool system when he was mayor that had little penises on them instead of nipples.
Right.
You know, that was spread around in a film on WhatsApp. It was a fake film that was made. So it was the lowest possible dirty tricks imaginable that were illegally used in violation of campaign finance laws, in violation of internet laws in Brazil, and in violation of electoral laws that propelled Bolsonaro to victory, first of all. And if you'd like, I could debunk the corruption and violence.
Yes. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I consider both of these things. Have you ever read On Television by Pierre Bourdieu?
Yes, actually, back in college. I had to read some
back
of it.
Back in college, yeah.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah.
But anyway, he's a very great critic of the media, and he always says that people in the media are failed intellectuals, which hurts.
Thanks a lot. I was going to say.
Yeah, hurts, but I know who he's talking about. He's not talking about people like us. But what he talks about a lot are these mind-stopping cliches. People in the media speak in sound bites.
Yeah.
Newspaper writers, journalists break every complex issue down to an either-or thing, and they string together these cliches that cause people to stop thinking and because it sounds familiar and move on to the next subject. And so violence and corruption are mind-stopping cliches. If you say people are angry about violence, you're going to think, well, everybody hates violence, you know, and the same for corruption. But they don't hold up to any scrutiny, because in Brazil, the state that gave the most support to Bolsonaro, Sao Paulo, 25% of all of his votes came from Sao Paulo, which is like economically and population-wise the California of Brazil. It has 20% of the country's population living in it. So he got a quarter of his votes came from Sao Paulo. Sao Paulo has violence rates lower than most, you know, than many places in the U.S. The capital city of Sao Paulo, also called Sao Paulo, has a murder rate. Its murder rate dropped from 60 out of, you know, 60 murders for 100,000 residents in 2000 down to 7.8 in 2017, which is like less than a quarter of the murder rate in Chicago right now, and comparable with New York or other cities. That's where he got most of his votes. The most violent states in Brazil, mostly in the Northeast, all carried Fernando Haddad. So if people were voting out of concerns for violence, then Haddad was their candidate, not Bolsonaro, you know?
Yep.
And then in terms of corruption, Bolsonaro's from the – he spent 90% of his political career in the most corrupt political party in Brazil, the Partido Progressista, ironically called the Progressive Party, right? Because it's an out branch from the dictatorship. The party leader is on Interpol's most wanted list, Paulo Maluf, and he'll be arrested the second he steps out of Brazil. He hasn't been able to leave the country for 15 years because he stole $200 million from Sao Paulo city coffers in one day in the 1990s and put it in Swiss bank accounts.
That's impressive. You know, that's a real take.
And Bolsonaro was in that party at the time. You know, right. Bolsonaro like didn't leave his party over that. And so he's already started naming his cabinet ministers, and they're almost all corrupt. You know, one of his the man he wants to lead his coalition in Congress is currently serving 4 years of semi-open imprisonment, which is a weird sentencing thing they have in Brazil, where you go to jail during the day. No, you go to jail at night, and you can go out during the day. So this guy is actually he's in the penal justice system right now. And, you know, several of his cabinet ministers have been busted taking bribes, supervaluing construction projects. So it's not – corruption is not an issue at all to Brazilian voters who voted for Bolsonaro. If it were, they wouldn't have voted for him. It's that the corruption is like a code word for communist now in Brazil.
Right. Well, we're going to get specifically to the U.S. corporate sector and then Moro and political imprisonment of Lula in a minute, because that's the other kind of important part of this story. But do you think, or integral to this story, but do you think that there's obviously my reading of Brazilian politics, and you'll know this better than me, but my reading of Brazilian politics is that it is. I mean, it's different than the United States, but there are parallels, and there's just certain structural corruptions. So in order to form a government, as an example, as Lula and Dilma both had to do, they needed to cut deals with various smaller parties. And a lot of these smaller parties in Brazil, my reading is that they run almost just like tributaries. Like, oh, they're tiny, like you and I, like, hey, you know what, Brian, let's form like the Progressive Union Party. And we'll get a couple of seats in parliament, and then we'll just kind of shop around for who will give us the most bribes, essentially. So, and obviously, the car wash investigation did reveal some things that cut across the political spectrum. So, there's a structural corruption problem in Brazil, but even there, as an example, there's a difference between personal enrichment and realizing that you might need to help, you know, get campaign funds, as an example. And somehow this anti-corruption rhetoric just became, as you said, it just became a synonym for communist or to attack the left. And I do want to draw a global comparison, because it seems like from Italy in the 90s, which led to Berlusconi, and I know Moro studied that, to even the way Donald Trump talked about drain the swamp, there's this generic anti-corruption, which doesn't mean anything specific, and then fascists use it to destroy even the most modest left parties.
Yeah, I agree. It goes back to, I think, the original fascism, right? Didn't Mussolini and Hitler used to accuse the socialists that they were murdering of being corrupt? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's an easy way to slander somebody. In the case of Brazil, yeah, I mean, I think capitalism is corrupt.
Exactly.
And the main engine for corruption is the private sector, which is why I think it's so outrageous that you have organizations like Transparency International, which receive corporate funding, going around ranking governmental officials in the third world about how corrupt they are and completely ignoring who's paying them with the corrupt money, you know?
Yep.
Completely ignoring the people driving corruption. So, you know, the organizations driving corruption in the world are the real estate industry, the oil industry, you know, the drug industry. So it's impossible, I think, to have a capitalist society that's not corrupt. Even Sweden, which prides itself in not being corrupt, from what I understand, the Swedish military is the biggest bribe payer in Africa.
Yep.
This is what Patrick Bond told me, anyway, from University of Johannesburg. And so, yeah. And regarding like parties and coalition building, the difference between Brazil and the U.S. is that there's just a lot more parties. And one of the reasons the political system is so corrupt is that they gave amnesty to everybody who was collaborating with the military dictatorship, and they let the two official parties from the dictatorship continue. And when Lula took office, they were the first and second biggest parties in Brazil. The PFL, which is now called the Democrats, Dem, and the PMDB. And so it wasn't just small parties. In order for him to get a 50% majority needed to do anything in Congress, he had to go into coalition with one of those two parties that was a legacy from the dictatorship. So he chose the official opposition party from the dictatorship, the MDB. And they're the ones that eventually stabbed Dilma Rousseff in the back. That's Michel Temer's party.
Yep.
You know, and then
who's the sitting president now?
Sitting president now, the Weimar Republic of Brazil guy, basically, is what they're calling him now.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, just the sort of very, you know, just the two-bit corrupt austerity, you know, personal enrichment and whatever U.S. corporations want to do to the Brazilian people kind of guy. Okay, so talk about, run us through the political prosecution of Lula and Sergio Moro and the U.S. role. I always want to anchor, I will be always saying this now. I Noam Chomsky's right. I mean, this is the most prominent political prisoner in the world. And it's also a guy who, well, you'll complicate this in a minute because he did resist Western, he did resist Anglo capital in some ways, but was a conciliatory social democrat who made massive social strides for his country. I mean, is my understanding is, you know, I mean, certainly one of the, if not the most important and successful Brazilian politician, while cutting deals with capital. And they ruthlessly set out to destroy him, his party, but also the aspirations that he represents in the poor and in labor and in democracy in Brazil.
Yeah, that's basically, you summed it up pretty well. They're trying to wipe all memory of him and his party off the map, you know?
Yep.
Bolsonaro's son just announced, he just introduced a bill today to outlaw communism in Brazil, and they're going to try and include the PT party as communist in that, then outlaw the party, which is ridiculous because they were never that. There's some pretty radical people inside the party. There's internal currents. They have one called socialism or barbarianism, mm-hmm. just, you know, hard socialist. But essentially, they're social democratic party. They're ideologically aligned probably with someone like Bernie Sanders.
Yep.
But anyway, so Sergio Moro has been working with the U.S. government since at least 2009. We know this from leaked WikiLeaks cables. And essentially, he decided, along probably with the Department of Justice people who are in constant communication with him the whole time, as Kenneth Blanco admitted in a speech in the Atlantic Council last year, which you can watch online.
And who's Kenneth Blanco? Who is he? Who's Kenneth?
He was Assistant Attorney General of the United States.
Okay.
You know, he gave a speech in the Atlantic Council talking about the constant informal communication between the DOJ and and Sergio Moro.
And what is Sergio Moro's official position in Brazil that allowed him to launch this investigation to target and destroy Lula and PT?
He's a local, what we call a district judge, okay? Mm-hmm. And so even his arrest of Lula's totally illegal because it's not even in his district. Lula committed no crimes in his district. His district is Curitiba. And so originally they pressed charges against Lula that he'd been involved in Petrobras corruption and bribes involving one Petrobras office in Curitiba just so that Moro could justify getting Lula into his jurisdiction. But he himself threw out his own charges of that, you know, because this is the other thing. They never changed the law in Brazil when the Inquisition ended, and a prosecutor can still, a judge can still rule on his own prosecution. Judges also work as prosecutors and investigators, and they can judge their own prosecutions with no jury. And so that's what Moro did to Lula. After years of leaking all kinds of phony information into the media, much of which was reproduced unquestionably in The Guardian, The New York Times, and The Washington Post. They gave a press conference saying that Lula was the head of a massive international money laundering and criminal organization, and that he had $15 million in cash in his bank accounts and stuff. When they finally seized his assets, the total amount of cash that Lula had in his bank accounts was $230,000, which at the time was half of what Obama was charging for one speaking engagement.
Right.
Okay. And Lula's still living in the apartment he's been living in since the 1980s in basically the Trenton, New Jersey of São Paulo, São Bernardo dos Campos, which is like a factory suburb, toxic waste zone.
Yep.
You know, so he's not someone who, there's no evidence that he ever made any money whatsoever through any kind of corruption. They arrested him. They convicted him of charges related to this apartment, this penthouse apartment on the beach. They leaked to the media that its value was like something like $600,000, basically, this apartment, and that he'd received all of these illegal reforms, including the building of an elevator inside of it, because it's a two-floor apartment or three-floor apartment or whatever. And but they refused to let the press visit the building. They refused to let the press visit the apartment. They refused to allow Lula's team to show any photos of the apartment. And it's an apartment that, basically, it seems like Lula's wife was thinking of buying an apartment in that building, and the construction company offered her a slightly better apartment for the same price because they thought it would be positive publicity to sell more units. Mm-hmm. You know? And mm-hmm. this is after Lula left office.
Yep.
Even if he had received the apartment, there's no quid pro quo because he wasn't in any position of power. He was a civilian at the time. But they never took the offer because basically since 2005, when they tried to stage a coup against Lula for corruption in the Mensalão scandal, which was also fabricated by the media and Lula's political enemies, basically, he was always very careful about this kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, because he knew he was constantly being, followed around in attack. So, no, they refused the apartment. There's no evidence that that he ever accepted it. There's no evidence that he owns it. It's in the deed to the apartments in the name of the construction company that built it. Okay, they've never been in there. It's an empty apartment. And after Lula was arrested, a squatters movement called the MTST, they invaded the building with video cameras and took photos and video of the entire apartment and showed Brazil that it wasn't worth anywhere near $600,000, that there'd been no reforms done on it
right.
whatsoever. There was no elevator in there. And so the only evidence that Sergio Moro had to convict Lula was one plea bargain testimony by a corrupt businessman who changed his testimony three times to better fit what Moro was looking for in exchange for 70% sentence reduction and transfer to house arrest and partial retention of his assets, his illicit assets. And that's the only evidence. And so in order to convict Lula, Moro had to argue in court that Lula was guilty because he believed he was guilty. I have conviction that Lula's guilty.
Hmm.
And then sentenced to 9 years. Now Bolsonaro's taking office. Lula might very well die in prison now over this. You know, because they're not going to let him go. Unless they can get him out before Bolsonaro takes power.
And then during the whole campaign, the Supreme Court obviously ignored international law. The UN determined to be clear, I mean, international law is, I mean, in my view, I mean, international law is obviously always subordinate to power relations. But unlike in the United States, where we pretty overtly say we don't follow international protocols, Brazil actually has been party to these UN directives, and has actually sort of made a show of saying that they'll take these things seriously and incorporate it into law. The UN, a responsible body, said that Lula absolutely had a right to run for president and needed to be allowed to run for president. He was blocked from running for president, and then, on top of it, blocked from having access to any press, even as the whole time, as you said in the beginning, he led by double digits in the polls. And, you know, it just is amazing that these people who, you know, including plenty of people here in the sort of Washington Post, New York Times circles who smeared Lula and didn't study what happened in Brazil, what was happening in Brazil at all. Lula's sort of conciliatory, moderate, but also, I mean, I guess, but also genuinely social democratic and labor based. So maybe that's even too left for them. But he would have governed as a great national conciliate. Like, he would have been, let's reconcile Brazil and get out of economic stagnation and get things going again. I mean, it's like, it's funny, like PT's slogan, I think, was like, let Brazil be happy again. And this, yeah. And this was not good enough for the establishment, essentially. And maybe this is where we're going to get some video in a second, but maybe just also explain that as part of Lula's reconciling so many impulses, he appeased maybe Brazilian business while he brought tens of millions out of poverty, but he didn't appease U.S. interests. And that's why, even though he was getting praised and feted around the world, maybe this is why there was support for Sergio Moro and going after Lula, and also a broader reversal of the Latin American pink tide.
Well, Lula, you know, he partially appeased U.S. interests.
Right.
And that seemed good enough for a time until they discovered massive offshore oil deposits in Brazil. And at that point, it's like, no, we have to have total control over this country. Hmm. I think that's what – if they hadn't discovered all of that oil – maybe things would have been very different today in Brazil, because you just look at the big oil nations. This offshore oil discovery propelled Brazil like into the top 5 or 6 oil producing nations in the world. And you look at the other ones and see how many have been invaded or had their governments overthrown by the U.S. You know, it's not a good position to be in to have that much oil these days. You know, but Lula, for example, there's a woman named Renata Mota, who's a professor at Free University of Berlin, who's Brazilian, who wrote a book about Lula's relationship with GMOs, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And, he freed up GMOs, which was historically, the PT was the biggest enemy of GMO technology, not because it's unhealthy or something, but because the way that GMOs are used to restructure agriculture,
right,
favoring agribusiness against family farmers, right?
Right.
But in her book, she says, basically, Lula sacrificed every historic objective of the PT party and its followers, except for eliminating hunger and poverty reduction.
Right.
Okay, so he in his mind, he was like, the only way I'm going to get this done is by basically selling out all of our other ideals. But he lifted 40 million people out of poverty and practically ended hunger.
Right.
And, you know, hunger was a really big issue in Brazil in the 1990s. And you have whole regions of the the country where the average person had growth stunting from malnutrition. You know, people were starving to death. So, you know, but so he threw some bones to the Americans. You know, he made Monsanto and Dow and these companies happy when he freed up GMOs. He privatized a little bit of the offshore oil reserves. Dilma privatized a little bit more. You know, trying to make this, keep this balance going. We're like giving the U.S. enough, giving international enough, international capital enough that they wouldn't turn on Brazil. But I guess they, you know, at some point it just got to the point where the international capitalists in the U.S. state and everything were just like, no, we want it all. We don't want any more compromises from you guys. We're taking it all. And that's what they did. And they've got it all now.
Yeah, we want another round of pure primitive accumulation. We're in a few minutes, we're going to get to what we might do in terms of a broader solidarity project with Brazil. But I do want to play this clip, and this is going to annoy some people, and some people are going to have a tantrum about it because this is somebody that people are big fans of. But I do want to play this because I want to actually give an opportunity for, you know, I would love to see if Jimmy Dore used his platform to interview somebody like you and explain the crisis in Brazil, U.S. influence, the how, what, anything, if it's even possible to do to free Lula from prison, to protect LGBTQ and all the rest of it. But this is just another example of how even people in independent, self-proclaimed left media fall so easily into this delusional anti-corruption narrative. This is from 2017. This is a year after the coup against Dilma. And this is a clip that you wanted to speak about of the Jimmy Dore show just totally uncritically playing this Lava Jato Sergio Moro propaganda. And only, of course, a year later, he would be accepting a role in the fascist regime of Bolsonaro. So this is about 2 minutes, and then, Brian, I'll go to you.
Success in the legal procedures, but the success of changing the mindset is already happening.
We live in a window of opportunity for changes, and we are committed to use any chance, any possibility to make things better in Brazil. And doing so is a matter that is up to everybody.
Wow. That's kind of, I don't know, that kind of, that's amazing.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. I want to get a Lava Jato t-shirt.
Yeah, yes, me too. Right?
Yeah, I really want one.
So Lava Jato, that's car wash, I guess, in whatever. They speak Spanish, but I think they speak Portuguese, right?
Portuguese
in Brazil. So yeah, Lava Jato. So there, we met those guys, by the way. I got to meet those guys. I interviewed them.
I mean, that's incredible. I mean, I couldn't even see anything like that happening in the, I mean, usually in the United States,
where a senator would go to jail.
Let me just say, I actually could see it happening if Bernie Sanders is elected president. But Brian, your thoughts?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I just have to say that it sounds like they used erection medication background music in that video. That's my first.
Right.
My first comment. At the time that video came out, to give you an idea of what a scumbag Sergio Moro is, he had already invited the media to accompany the police to arrest Dilma's finance minister, Guido Mantega, during one of his wife's chemotherapy sessions in a hospital, right? He'd done that before that video came out, okay? And this is the type of sadism that the Department of Justice uses when it goes after white-collar criminals, like it did with some of the people connected to Enron, and when they shut down Arthur Anderson and 30,000 people lost their jobs over something that turned out to be a mistake, they go after people, and they scare them. They're sadistic. And, of course, Guido Mantega, it turned out he had done nothing wrong. But he was on the news as a criminal being pulled out of his wife's chemotherapy session because of Sergio Moro, you know? So I just don't – I know that Brazil is a very complicated country to understand. Tom Jobim said Brazil's not for beginners. It took me about 10 years living down here before I actually started talking about or writing much about Brazil except for personal stories, you know? fictionalized stuff, because it's a very complicated country to get around. And then there's this massive propaganda machine, and there are all of these interests and people who work for corporations and get corporate funding to infiltrate the left and to spread these kinds of – leak these kinds of narratives into the left. I can understand how someone who doesn't know a lot about Brazil would be confused by the erection medication mute background music, maybe, and want to buy the T-shirt. But if you are on the left, you have to have some responsibility to just speak about things that you know about. And if you don't know enough, like you don't know what language they speak in Brazil, you probably shouldn't be playing up this Department of Justice lackey with this stupid video if you don't even know what language they speak there. Yeah.
Well, that was one of the first conversations that you and I had, Brian. I said, I'd like to talk about Lula because I admire him. I want to have a grounding in what's happening in Brazil now. And Portuguese or Spanish?
Yeah. Well, I don't remember that.
I'm just kidding. Brian, what can we do? I mean, I on every level from, I mean, maybe giving us a sense of like, because I know, I mean, look, there's, as you said, it's like 40 million people that he's trying to criminalize. Obviously, it's first going to target indigenous people and gay and lesbian people and people in center left and left parties and so on. But there's a lot of Brazilians that obviously don't embrace the thuggery, savagery, and wholesale sell-off of their country. And there have been people, you know, Bernie Sanders, as you know, has spoken consistently on the political imprisonment of Lula. Mark Pocan, congressman from Wisconsin, is actually, he wrote a good op-ed about this with Danny Glover last week on the Hill. I guess give us a sense of what people in Brazil are thinking in terms of strategies for countering this and what we might do in the United States, even on every level. I mean, from even the idea of, like, as you said, I mean, even potentially trying to get Lula out of there before the transition, and also the longer term strategy to save Brazil from this.
Well, I'm going to start with a quote from John Ross, who's a developmentalist economist who's in China now, but he worked for the London city government, and he worked for Hugo Chavez in the early years a little bit. And he posted on his Facebook a couple of days ago, a fascist has become president of Brazil, but a fascist regime is not yet established in Brazil. The two are not the same. It is a key duty of international solidarity to aid the Brazilian people to prevent such a regime being created. Okay, and I guess that's a good starting point. Now, how we're going to do it, I don't know, because, for example, when Lula was arrested illegally and held as a political prisoner, his defense team went to the United Nations. But this coup government has shown that it's not going to respect the United Nations. And Bolsonaro is now saying he's going to withdraw from the UN and the Paris Accord. Okay, and then what would the next thing be to do? Oh, get the U.S. government to step in and defend victims of human rights abuses. Well, Trump's not going to do that, is
right,
he?
Right, you know, of course, right,
I think the one thing to do would be to try and help Democrats take Congress.
Yep.
But Obama is the guy, you know, his administration is behind the coup. So it's not just the Democrats, I think, who would step in. It's the progressive Democrats.
Right.
And so I don't know what power the Progressive Caucus, and I believe the Congressional Black Caucus has also been involved in a lot of solidarity for Lula and whatnot. I don't know what power they have to do anything. And I just really, I guess the only thing you can, not the only thing, maybe some people who are listening have better ideas than me. I'm just, the first step, I guess, would be to take back the House. So at least you could get some people with authority in the U.S. government pressuring against Bolsonaro's human rights abuses.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know, maybe Ben Fogel said, he's South African, he said, help set up a place for refugees to flee to or whatever. But if he's really going after everyone on the left, there's no country that can absorb that, right. Which is why I don't think he's really going to go that far, you know, but in a way, I'm almost rooting for China to step in or something, you know?
Well,
judges, but I think they'd be better than Trump.
They'd be better, although I think, you know, they like to make deals. They don't have any problem with deals. But yeah, I mean, but that's fascinating, because actually so many conversations that we have on this show, you know, there's obviously a longer term strategies and conversations that go far outside of the Democratic Party and the progressive currents of the Democratic Party. And conversely, this is lesson number. I mean, we could take this now from the most micro of but really important of millions of people in their pre-existing conditions to, you know, student loans. And then we can keep kind of inflating it out. And then we go to Brazil and it comes down to go out there and, you know, fucking vote on Tuesday, for God's sake. I mean, seriously, you need to do that. And I think it's very important. I'll start putting out more, but Mark Pocan, Ro Khanna, Bernie Sanders, Barbara Lee. I mean, people you'd expect, the good people, Keith Ellison, the good people in Congress have talked about this. I think this does need to be something, though, that we push to, you know, the left people that haven't gotten on board yet, whether it's AOC or Elizabeth Warren. But I think also, even moving forward, frankly, even if it's insincere, we do need to go at, the Obama wing of the party and say, look, I mean, in a certain way, this is obviously the bet you made. And then on the other side of it, this is actually everything that you're supposed to support. I mean, this is a moderate, multicultural, social force that is being totally crushed. And if you have any sincerity about your commitments to, you know, non-authoritarianism or women's rights or anything, you better be talking about and working on, you know, protecting people in Brazil, getting rid of Bolsonaro and freeing Lula, even if you erred mightily in the past. Repent now.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. And I feel like I talked to Mark Weisbrot about this, you know, and
yeah.
He seems to think that the Obama administration just basically was busy in the Middle East and just let the career State Department ghouls do whatever they wanted in Latin America. And that's why there were coups in Honduras and Paraguay and Brazil. It wasn't something that Obama was actively involved in. And maybe his side of the Democratic Party could be made to feel responsible for this and pressured to try and at least, you know, I don't think you'll ever get the corporate Democrats to pressure Brazil to, like, stop privatizing petroleum
and right.
restricting pesticide use in Brazil. But at the very least, maybe to pressure the Brazilian government into not being openly, overtly fascist and committing human rights atrocities. You know, the new governor of Rio, who's one of Bolsonaro's buddies, he's trying to pass a law that allows policemen to operate as snipers and just shoot drug dealers as they're standing on the corner trying to sell drugs from a distance right now. Yep. And Tamar's own justice minister told him that's illegal.
Well, it was also illegal that you guys had a coup and got rid of a competent, good government. So, great. But I think that there has to be some sense of, and I will say before we, you know, wrap up, I do my read, and you and Mark Weisbrot would certainly know better than me, that yes, I think to the extent that there was a senior level administration official that was more involved in this atrocious turn against, you know, center left governments in Latin America, it's much more Hillary Clinton than Barack Obama, which, you know, doesn't, you know, exonerate him. He should have been doing a lot more. And he had, you know, people like Lula should have been his closest allies and people he supported. But I do think, going back to the coup in Honduras, where the Honduran coup regime hired that, you know, snake, phony, weird, creepy Lonnie Davis as a lobbyist and so
and
on.
And
Otto Reich, yeah.
They hired both of them, yeah. Anyway, continue.
But I'm just thinking, Lonnie specifically, with his very weird relationship with the Clintons, you know, Hillary Clinton's track record in Latin America was abominable. So maybe there's a way of potentially disaggregating some of the, you know, Obama wing from the Clinton wing with regards to that, in terms of just the strategy just going forward, even regardless of the history.
Well, it would be... I think, honestly, like the best hope for any Americans who want to show solidarity with Brazil is to at least get the Democrats in charge of Congress.
Yep.
So at least, I mean, remember in the 80s, I don't know if you remember, but it was the Democratic Congress that blocked the Reagan administration from giving military aid to the Contras.
Yep.
And Iran-Contra started when they illegally subverted that. You know, but at least there were people like, even John Kerry was really good on Latin America in the 80s, you know?
Yep.
But so hopefully everyone will go out and vote, and everyone can convince 10 friends to go out and vote for Democrats, and ask them, their 10 friends, to convince 10 friends, and the Democrats can take back the House at least. And at that point, I think we could really start talking about strategies on how Americans could help, you know, Brazil in this fight against fascism.
And it's our fight, just even with the Amazon alone, which is another time. We'll talk about that another time. But Brian Mir, I really appreciate your time as always. Co-editor of the Brazil Wire. Brian, I mean, sincerely, solidarity, and thank you for everything you do. And please stay safe.
I'll try. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thank you. All right, folks, we went a little bit long, but I think that was, I mean, it's just necessary. I do think that's amazing that even the Brazil conversation ends with vote. Like, this is not a time to be a performative idiot, right? I mean, like, this actually really matters. And power is power. And he's absolutely right from what I've studied of. In Latin America policy in the 1980s, you even had a guy like Chris Dodd saying that the United States government and the Reagan administration does not understand the difference between Soviet backing and indigenous insurgency, and said we should not fight the Sandinistas. We should not fight them. So, and they also overrode the Reagan administration to put sanctions on South Africa. And some of these people actually get what's going on in Brazil. So, at any rate, for patrons of TMBS, you've already seen a notification, and a lot of you have already bought tickets to the first Michael Brooks Show live show that's happening at the Bell House February 1st in Gowanus, Brooklyn. Gowanus part of Brooklyn. Special guests so far are Bhaskar Sunkara, Alona Minkowski, T, Trevor Beaulieu, and possibly, hopefully, Big Waz, Wozni Lambre. And then, of course, Matt Leck and David Grisham are with me. There's two different ticket options, one where you can come and hang out with us for a couple of hours before the show, another where, you know, you stay for the whole live show. It's going to be we're going to do a lot of stuff. It's not going to just be like a live podcast. We're going to have, like, hopefully some type of like games, the audience. It's going to be incredibly fun. We're mapping it out, planning it now. And we just announced it just to patrons just late on Tuesday. And already a lot of people have bought tickets. So, and for patrons, double check the promo code that you got for your deals. And if you haven't been a patron of the Michael Brooks Show yet, do so at patreon.com/TMBS and get a full, broad, and global political education. But for starting tomorrow, we will have the tickets will be available for the general public. And even if you're not a patron, which God knows why you wouldn't be, it would be awesome to come to meet you and come see us. It's going to be a really fun show. February 1st at the Bell House. The first live Michael Brooks show with Bhaskar Sunkara, Alona Minkowski, Trevor T from Champagne Sharks, and hopefully Big Waz from Count the Dings. This Sunday, we did a sort of kind of Middle East breakdown with Mike Hanna, who covers the UN for Al Jazeera. We talked about the Khashoggi murder, how Turkey's using it to leverage against the prince in Saudi Arabia, how that relates to the Qatar blockade and the Emirati strategy for the region. Very global, very high level, very Mike Hanna. There were sirens in the background as Mike Hanna said, "Well, the interesting thing, Michael," I wish I could speak like Mike Hanna. That guy has a great voice. This Tuesday, we're actually unlocking the post game with Harvey Kay. Subscribe to us on iTunes and watch our YouTube channel, Michael Brooks Show, on YouTube. And if you haven't become a patron yet, patreon.com/TMBS. Jamie, talk about the Antifada.
All right. So yesterday on the Antifada, we released a very spooky Halloween episode featuring the Lit Crit guy, very pleasant British academic, talked about Gothic Marxism, how Marx used the Gothic, which was a trend at that point in time when he was writing, to add some flair to his descriptions and really make his ideas come alive for people. The idea that you should honor what's going on in pop culture and not just dismiss it when constructing some kind of a left critique is really important to this day, I think.
Definitely.
We talked about horror movies and what they say about the society that creates and elevates them.
At a certain point, Jason's going to want to take off his hockey mask. He's going to ask himself, is this what I want to do?
Yeah, totally.
After Freddy Krueger slashes up that party, this the favor is going to break.
At some point, right? No,
right.
Obviously not. we talked about Mandy and Hereditary, which are two really good horror movies of this year. Kind of gave our takes on them. We talked about witches, zombies, vampires. It was super fun. And coming this weekend, I want to tease this a little bit. We've got Jay Firestone, which is not his real name,
really?
Who infiltrated the alt-right in New York City and wrote a very good article about it for Commune magazine. So we're really stoked about that.
Sweet. Matt.
Literary Hangover. I've mentioned the Pequot War history. For members, this weekend there's going to be a conversation between me and Alex. The next full episode is going to be pushed back a week so we can have Grace from the UK join us to talk about Hope Leslie. But
cool.
Members, there's going to be a bonus show for you, so check that out.
Very cool. Of course, become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. It's how this show happens. Subscribe to this show on iTunes, write an iTunes review. Subscribe on YouTube. We've passed 400,000, moving right along at a fast clip. We'll see you in the fun half.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
Damn, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.